Okay, so let's start. And as you, surprise, surprise, it's going to be the Maha Parinibbana Sutta, the great sutta on the Buddha's passing away. And we are approaching the 3-year anniversary on this sutta, which is kind of exciting. But anyway, that's coming up soon. We should have some balloons, I think, or whatever, on the 3-year anniversary day. So we have seen so far how the, you know, we're getting very close now to the Buddha's passing away. And we have seen how he, his last disciple got ordained, became a monk, and how he practiced and later on became an arahant. And how the Buddha is kind of laying down various things so that the sasana or the Buddhism or the Dhamma can last also for the future. So this is what we're seeing now, and we're getting closer and closer. And today we probably go, we should easily go past the Buddha's actual passing away today. So this, now we are on what is there, paragraph 6.4. So hopefully you got that there. And this is getting very close to the Buddha's very last advice and instructions to the monks. So here he says, after my passing, the monk Channa is to receive the Brahma penalty. But Lord, what is the Brahma penalty? Says Venerable Ananda. And the Buddha replies, whatever the monk Channa wants or says, he... Okay, so whatever the monk Channa wants or says, he is not to be spoken to, admonished, or instructed by the monks. Actually, the translation here is not really all that great. What it really means is something like whatever he may say what he likes or something like that is really what it means. And then in return, he's not to be spoken to at all. So this is the Brahma penalty here. And usually Brahma means like the Brahma Viharas, like the metta and compassion and things. This doesn't sound like a very compassionate penalty. And this is kind of sometimes the problem with these not really translating properly. It's very hard for most people to understand what the Brahma penalty means in this kind of context. But the idea of Brahma in Buddhism is the idea of something which is very kind of very high level of things. Yeah, it's kind of the almost like the highest level you can be reborn in samsaric existence is Brahma. So it refers to something which is very elevated and very high, not just high in the sense of beautiful, good qualities, but also high in the sense of being extreme. So here this is like the extreme punishment or penalty that you give in as a Buddhist monastic. Yeah, you give to other monks, and the highest punishment you can give is not to talk to somebody. Yeah. And this is interesting. This is actually a sutta about this. There is a sutta with the Buddha, where there's a layman who says to the Buddha, he says, well, you know, what do you do if the monks don't kind of listen to you? Well, I kill them, he said, the Buddha says. And we're, what? What do you mean you kill them? Well, you know, if some, and then he explains, well, the way to kill a monk is not to speak to them. You stop instructing them. This is the meaning of kind of killing, because it's tantamount. If you don't get instructed, you're not going to make any progress. So you are almost as if you are dead to the Dhamma, to the, you know, to Buddhism in a sense. So in that sense, you have been kind of killed, metaphorically killed by the Buddha. This is how the Buddha kills people, according to the suttas. So if you ever want to get away with killing, that's how you get away with killing in the suttas. So it's strange that the Buddha should use that metaphor, but that's actually what's found in that sutta. So what is this all about? And what this is about is that the monk Channa, for those of you who know a little bit about the Buddhist mythology and the history of Buddhism, you will know that Channa was supposed to be the charioteer of the Buddha before he left the household life. and he was a charioteer. For example, there's a sutta in the Digha Nikaya called the Mahapadana Sutta, which talks about all the things that happen to someone who's to become a Buddha. Yeah, and these are universal principles that happen to all Buddhas. So that's why it is in this Mahapadana Sutta. Mahapadana Sutta is about Mahapadana is like the great story or something like that. And it's an archetypical story that happens to everyone, supposedly, who's to become a Buddha. This is like part of the mythology and the legend of Buddhism or of Buddhas in general. And according to this legend, which we find in this particular sutta, the Buddha then goes into the city. Yeah, and you know how that story goes. He goes into the city, he sees a dead person or a sick person, an old person, a dead person, and then the ascetic, the one who's gone forth. This is the story. Of course, the reality that we know from the suttas is that the Buddha just contemplated these things. This is what you find. This is what you find in the where the Buddha talks about his own life stories. When you move away from the legend and mythology, the reality of things is that the Buddha contemplated these things. And then this gets then set in a mythological context. It then becomes the charioteer who takes you out and shows you these sights. So for this reason, according to this, Channa got very conceited, yeah, because he took the Buddha to be out into the city. He showed him all of these marks, the lakana of existence, the nature of existence, and based on that, the Buddha then decides to go forth. So he feels very important, yeah, this Channa, according to this. And later on, Channa is also the person who helps the Buddha to be to escape from the household life. Yeah, it takes him out of the household life, and is a charioteer who kind of, you know, together with the horse Kantaka, they escape the city. All of this is really mythology. But this is how Channa kind of later on became known to be very conceited and arrogant. And in some places he says, oh, the Buddha is mine. Yeah, the Buddha is mine. I'm not going to listen to you guys, the Buddha is mine. And there's a large number of the rules, monastic rules, some of them very serious rules that were laid down in because of Channa and his conduct. So they would admonish him for having broken certain very important rules. And he would say, go away, I don't want to listen to you. Or he would just be stubborn, he would just sit there silently without responding and then continue doing exactly the same thing. And this was kind of the background story for Channa. And once you know that, you understand why this comes about. Yeah, the exact connection here between the mythology of Channa and who he was as a historical person is not very clear. He obviously was someone who was difficult, but that is the story which kind of lies behind this action or this particular, what the Buddha is saying here, basically. So that's why he should be given the Brahma penalty, because when someone does not react anymore, they don't take any advice or admonishment anymore, there's only one thing you can do, and that is stop speaking to them. If you speak to someone who is refusing to listen, you're wasting your time and nothing can really happen. You need to kind of get them to understand what is going on. And the story of Channa is actually quite nice, because after the Buddha then dies, and this is found in another part of the Buddhist suttas, it's not actually found in this particular sutta, so I might as well tell it now, so it kind of becomes part of this. And after the Buddha passes away, Venerable Ananda, he goes to Venerable Channa, and he says, Venerable, from now on, we're not going to speak to you anymore. Whatever you do, whatever you might want to say, we're not going to have anything to do with you. And that is when he understands the importance of what's going on. The Buddha has passed away. That was his one refuge. He doesn't have that refuge anymore. And the rest of the Sangha has kind of dismissed him, not going to talk to him. And that, at that point, he understands what's going on. So he kind of mends his ways. He turns around, and apparently he becomes then an arahant soon after that. So that is the story of Channa, possibly the Buddha's charioteer or whatever, before he went forth. Okay, so that is why that is happening. And if you don't get spoken to at all by the monks, then no, I don't know if that's ever going to happen. But okay, as always, if you want to say anything or question anything or add anything as we go along, please feel free to do so. So next, we move on to the next part here. Then the Lord addressed the monks, saying, "It may be, monks, that some monks has doubt or uncertainty about the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, or about the path or the practice. Ask, monks, do not afterwards feel remorse, thinking, the teacher was there before us, and we failed to ask the Lord face to face." At these words, the monks were silent. The Lord repeated his words a second and a third time, and still the monks were silent. Then the Lord said, "Perhaps, monks, you do not ask out of respect for the teacher. Then, monks, let one friend tell it to another." But still, they were silent. So what is this all about? And this is probably what we would expect a Buddha to do, or maybe any teacher to do, before they are about to pass away, to kind of give the Sangha or his community of disciples an opportunity at the very end to ask any questions. It kind of seems natural that you would do that. So it sort of makes sense, yeah? The Buddha takes until his very last breath, he gives a teaching if he has to. So if there had been any questions, then he would obviously answer those questions. And again, this is about the idea that the Buddha's only purpose in existence is to teach. Yeah, he doesn't have any purpose apart from teaching. And because of that, this is really what he does all the way to the very end. But I think there's another meaning behind this as well. It's like a symbolic meaning here as well. And I think the symbolic meaning is that his teaching is complete. There is nothing missing in his teaching. So when he asks the monks and they remain silent, obviously the symbol isn't there, is that actually there's nothing more to be said. Everything that needs to be said has been said. So it symbolizes the idea that the teaching is complete. And because the teaching is complete, now is a good time for the Buddha to pass away. Now is the right time. And this idea that the Buddhist teaching is complete is not just kind of found here in a symbolic sense, it's also found elsewhere in the suttas. And where the Buddha says, this is from the Pasadika Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, which is a little bit later on, number 29 in the Digha Nikaya. And where the Buddha says that in my teaching there is nothing superfluous and nothing lacking. Yeah, so this is kind of a similar idea to what you find here. And this is such an extraordinarily important idea, that the Buddha's teaching is complete. Nothing is superfluous and nothing is lacking. Because if we followed that literally, if we really thought that was the case, it would actually change so much of how we relate to Buddhism. Yeah, if you look at how most people relate to Buddhism in this world, there are actually very few people who really study the word of the Buddha. They study all kinds of other things. It's very rare for these things to be taken seriously. And that is why there is a lot of wrong view around the world about what Buddhist teaching really is about. There's the idea of the Acharya Vada. Vada means doctrine or teaching of the Acharyas, which are the teachers. But this is here, is the Buddha Vachana, which is the opposite of the Acharyavada, the word of the Buddha instead. Yeah, so if we really took this on board, it means that we would go back to these teachings of the Buddha. We would not be so concerned about other teachings. Yeah, this is what we would take as our gold standard, what Buddhism is really about, and we wouldn't be worried about other things. So the idea that Buddhism is complete is the first thing. You don't actually need anything more apart from the suttas. Okay, you need a little bit of explanation, but you always come back to the suttas again. Nothing more is really required. You don't really need any kind of fancy meditation systems or whatever on top of what you find in the suttas. Mindfulness of breathing will take you all the way to the end of the path. Simple, straight to the point. I shouldn't say simple, perhaps, but fairly simple. Yeah, you watch the breath going in and out, and of course that's hard enough, but it's not really complicated, if you know what I mean. Yeah, it's just you have to kind of just put in the foundation work. So there is nothing missing. So there is actually everything is there. And there is also nothing extraneous, nothing additional in this teaching. You can't throw anything out. You can't have seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, because the Noble Eightfold Path, by definition, has eight factors. If you throw some of them out, you're not going to have it anymore. Yeah? And so if we really took these things to heart, these very basic ideas of how to approach the suttas, we would have gone so much further down the Buddhist path, I think, around the Buddhist world than we otherwise do. And the tragedy, of course, is because you don't read the suttas, you don't get these kind of instructions. And because you don't get these instructions, you don't read the suttas. There's a catch-22 there, and it's very hard to get yourself out of it. Until one day someone reads the suttas and says, "What? Look at this. We've been going the wrong way all the time. We better do something." And then you change, and you kind of come back to the more appropriate way of doing things. So these things are seem simple on the surface, but actually they have very big ramifications for, you know, the whole practice and how we live the Buddhist life and what it is all about and how to find out what really is the Buddha teachings are about. So, and then the Buddha, he goes to great length, yeah, and of course that is also just to, again, to make the point that the teachings are complete, that people might feel a bit shy in the presence of the Buddha. So, you know, if you don't dare to ask directly, then ask kind of, you know, on the side. Instead, ask one of your friends, and then your friends will ask on your behalf. And you can imagine, being in the presence of the Buddha, you might very well be a bit shy. You may probably no reason to be shy, because I think the Buddha is not particularly dangerous, but still, people would still, that might still happen because of the reputation of the Buddha and all these kind of things. So, they were still silent, and the Venerable Ananda said, "It is wonderful, Lord, it is marvelous. I clearly perceive that in this assembly here, there is not one monk who has doubts or uncertainty. You, Ananda, speak from faith, but the Tathagata knows that in this assembly there is not one monk who has doubt or uncertainty about the Buddha, the Dhamma, or the Sangha, or the path, or the practice. Ananda, the least one of these 500 monks is a stream winner, incapable of falling into a state of woe, certain of Nibbana." So the 500 monks, so a very large assembly, yeah, maybe not 500, but large assembly anyway. The number 500 is a number which is used just to say large number. It doesn't really necessarily mean 500, it's a rounded number, but a large number of people there. No one there has any faith, any doubt about these things. Yeah, and if you have no doubt about the Dhamma, Sangha, the path, that means, basically, it means that you have insight into these teachings. You know what is going on. And that is why the least person there of these 500 is a stream winner, a sotapanna, one who has attained to the stream, incapable of falling into states of woe and certain of Nibbana. And this is a kind of an interesting description also of the stream winner, or the stream enter, as it's called elsewhere. This idea that you are incapable of falling into states of woe. In other words, these states of woe are it basically means a rebirth into a lower plane. That's what it refers to. And obviously it also refers to being incapable of having mental qualities in this life that are equivalent to these things. Yeah, obviously your mind is going to be very positive and bright. If you are a stream enter, you can't have any mental states that are equivalent to those states of woe, because it is those mental states that lead to a particular rebirth. So very often, because of that, people come to me and they say, or not just to me, probably to many, you know, many people, and say, "Oh, my kind of goal in this life is to become a stream enter, because I don't want to be reborn in the bad states." Yes, it's true. It's kind of sensible to become a stream mentor, of course, maybe even better to become an arahant. It all makes good sense. But it is a dangerous, I think, sometimes when we focus too much on these kind of goals, we actually reduce our ability to attain them. Because the focusing on the goal often is, you know, gives rise to desire, it gets maybe the ego a little bit into things, it gives rise to restlessness and agitation, and sometimes it reduces your ability to just focus on the here and now, on the practice instead. And especially if you do this out of fear, yeah, because you are afraid of these states of woe, they may not be very nice, but still, it is not good to act out of fear. So I wouldn't, even though this kind of is a goal which should, you know, maybe is nice to have at the back of your mind somewhere, really far at the back of your mind, it's not something that I would recommend people to focus too much on. focus instead on the practice, focus on the causes, know what kind of leads you onward, ask yourself whether you're making progress, is your mind getting more sharp, more clear, more gentle over the months, over the years. That is how you know that you're making progress. You want to look at your mental state now compared to what it was 6 months ago, a year ago, 5 years ago, etc. This is really how you think about things, instead of thinking about states or particular attainments, which I don't think it works basically. And this is of course something I have learned also in a large part from Ajahn Brahm, the idea not of focusing too much on the goals, especially coming from fear. So be careful of those things, even though it can be something that you keep at the back of your mind as something really worthwhile. And this is, of course, part of that. Yes, please.
I mean, I'm just trying to understand this a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that presupposes that simply strengthens my ego, isn't it? That I can do.
Yeah, exactly. And then when it feels the ego, it also tends to feel the doer. Yeah, because a very large part of the ego is the doer. And then you try to do the practice more than just allowing the practice to happen. That kind of often destroys your meditation practice. So all of these things tend to become the strong goals and strong idea that I'm going to attain the goal, which is kind of often come together, often lead to a wrong approach to the practice. And people striving too much, striving too hard, putting in kind of, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a stream enterer. And it's interesting, one of the things that Ajahn Chah supposedly said was that, don't be anyone, don't be an arahant, don't be a stream winner. And of course, the idea there is precisely this problem that we tend to put a sense of self into these things, when actually they are the opposite. They are the giving up of the sense of self that is the cause for the attaining of these things. So it's a tricky one. It has to be a goal in a certain way, but something that you kind of leave at the back of your mind. We don't really know what these things are anyway. They are really uncertain. Stream entry, okay. Maybe it sounds good, yeah, when you read about it on paper, yeah, you kind of give up the state of, you're certain about it. It sounds great, but because we don't really know what we're talking about, much better to think, okay, it makes me more happy when I practice in this way. This leads in the right direction. I have faith in this much because I've seen this much. And you keep on going. And then these things start to unfold as inner experiences rather than as ideas in the mind, which often can be very misleading anyway. Yeah. So, but there is a balance there, yeah, and... Yeah. Okay. So, and of course, certain of Nibbana, certain of extinguishment, you're certain to become extinguished. Extinguishing what? Extinguishing suffering, extinguishing defilements, extinguishing all kind of negative things. So, this is now the Buddha's coming very, very, very close to passing away. He has given the Sangha the last chance to ask questions. All questions have been resolved. Yes, Thomas? No, I think he's saying the least one of these 500. Huh?
Oh, so
yeah, they're all at least three mantras. Yeah, probably many arahants and whatever. Yeah. Okay. So. Now we come, I think we have to make a larger sign. I think it's one we have to kind of blow it up and make it really, I'm being naughty. Okay, so now we come to the very, very end. Yeah, this is like the big crescendo we're coming to now. Then the Lord said to the monks, "Now monks, I declare to you, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. Strive on untiringly. These were the Tathagata's last words. So this is a very famous statement by the Buddha, as you can imagine. Yeah, the very last words of the Buddha would have been very, very powerful and famous. Vaya Dhammo, Vaya Dhammo, Vaya Dhamma Sankara, appamadena sampadeta is the Pali, and this is kind of one of the things that many people who have grown up in a Buddhist culture will know by heart, this particular statement. This is the last thing, the very last words of the Buddha. So for that reason, very, very important. So first of all, let's get the translation really right, yeah? Because the translation here is a little bit iffy, I would say. First of all, it has the idea of decay here, but the Pali word is actually vaya, and vaya means something, not just something that decays, but something that comes to an end, something that ceases, yeah? So what it really means, vaya dhamma, it means the nature of coming to an end. Sankhara means all conditioned phenomena. And of course, all conditioned phenomena means everything, yeah? Yeah, there's nothing outside of conditioned phenomena. You could say Nibbana is outside, but you know, that's kind of irrelevant. As far as we're concerned, all conditioned phenomena, everything is impermanent. Yeah, this is what this is saying. Everything comes to an end. Everything ceases eventually. It may re-arise again, but then it comes to an end again. So this is one of those kind of crucial, very, very crucial ideas in Buddhism, that everything must come to an end. And I think if you fully understand this, then you also fully understand the power of the spiritual path and why the Buddhist teachings are so significant and important, and why they really work the way they do. So I would really, if you want to contemplate the Buddhist teachings, if you want to contemplate that simple fact that all conditioned phenomena are of a nature to end and to cease, you cannot really go very far wrong if you do that. So why does the Buddha say this right now? Well, obviously the way why he says this is because this summarizes the entire teachings. Yeah, if you get this, then you also get dukkha. You get dukkha, which is suffering. Why? Well, because if everything is impermanent, and we have our nature is to attach to things, then of course, if you're attached to impermanent stuff, you're going to suffer. So impermanence and suffering always go hand in hand. And if everything is impermanent, then of course, you cannot have a permanent essence in anything, yeah? So impermanence also refers to non-self at the same time. So everything is encapsulated in this idea of everything being impermanent. So it is very, very worthwhile reflecting on this and understanding what this is about. And I'm just going to repeat, these are things I talk about all the time because I think they are so important, and this really shows you how important it is. The very last word of the Buddha, this really kind of makes it very clear that this is absolutely fundamental to the Buddhist teachings. So how do we reflect on this in a way that is useful? And one of the most powerful ways is just to remember that what this means, first and foremost, the most important application of this teaching is to the external world. And by the external world, basically you mean the five senses, everything that comes in through the five senses. So every time you see something in the world outside of you that makes you upset, that makes you sad, that makes you suffer in one way or another, it means that you have fallen into this trap. You have taken something to be more permanent than it actually is. Do you ever watch the news or read the news and feeling upset about things? Has that happened to anyone? Maybe you don't read the news. Maybe you're too wise to read the news. But anyone who reads the news, occasionally you're bound to feel upset about things happening in the world. Yeah, regardless of your political persuasion, whatever it is, things go on in the world which are contrary to how you would like things to be. Yeah, so you read the news and think, well, there's wars and there's kind of people doing crazy things, and it's very hard not to sometimes to get a little bit upset when you read these things. And that is the problem right there. The world is out of control. The world is changing. Things are impermanent. Things are ceasing, coming to an end. You were looking for a certain way for the world to work in a certain way, but actually that way which the world was working has come to an end. Now it's working in a different way. This is what it means, vaya dhamma sankhara, things are coming to an end, changing. So whenever you see that there's something in the world which is not to your liking, well, that is the problem. That is, you haven't really reflected, understood impermanence fully enough yet. You haven't understood this last teaching of the Buddha. That's how powerful it is. Ideally, when you turn on the TV and you see something really bad happening in the world, you should say, oh yeah, of course it's happening. That's to be expected. Things are always changing. Things are always going. Sometimes they go according to you the way you'd like it to be. Sometimes they don't. It's just completely unreliable. You don't know what's going to happen next. And that is like the external world on TV, but everything within the sphere of the five senses is like that. Things that are much closer to you. Family relationships, yeah, your immediate world, your work, your family, the Buddha society here, Buddhism itself, all of this is encompassed within this. Things are always going to be uncertain. People dying, people getting sick, losing your job, absolutely everything in the world of the five senses. This is what we mean by the world of the five senses, everything around us. And this is the reason why this is so powerful, is that when you realize, when you start to contemplate this, and remember when we talk about contemplation in Buddhism, what you have, what we mean is something that you do again and again, building things up. It is a perception, an understanding, an outlook inside of yourself that you are building up, making it stronger and stronger over time. Yeah, this is very, I'm sure you would agree with this. Most people with common sense would agree with this straight away because it's so obviously true. But to actually internalize it and to make it something which is really powerful in your life, you have to think about it again and again and again until you stop being surprised when people in the world, when things in the world go the wrong way, whatever it might be. So what it does is that it turns your attention in a different direction. Instead of thinking about the world and finding security in the world, because that is essentially what we're doing. We're looking for security in the world. Yeah, I'm going to vote for this party. And when I vote for this party, they're going to get into power and they're going to sort out all the problems. I don't know if anyone believes that anyway, but you know, something like that. Yeah. And then you actually, it doesn't work like that. And so we take refuge in that world. We take refuge in things that are inherently problematic. Yeah. Yeah, even the best of relationships must break up one day. They are inherently problematic. And because of that, we change our refuge. Instead of taking refuge where there's no grounds for having refuge, you take it instead. First of all, you take it inside. And the reason why you take it inside, because we have some degree of power and ability to control our inner life, our intentions, the way we act, the way we live our lives. The world outside, obviously, the amount of control we have is all virtually very, very small. But for our inner lives, we have far more control. Even there, there are great limits, but at least we have some more control. So you start, you refocus. Suddenly, the spiritual life, living well, doing things that, making changes where they can happen, that is what you focus on instead. It's pretty obvious in many ways, yeah? And the reason why people aren't able to do this is because of lack of contemplation, lack of commitment. The lack of commitment comes from a lack of contemplation or understanding. The more you understand this, the more you focus on this, the more obvious it becomes. So this is like the first step of this idea of impermanence. Yeah, really make that something really big in your life, because this is kind of, it turns things upside down. The second step of impermanence is to understand that even your inner life is ultimately impermanent. Your inner life is more permanent than the external world. The external world is really out of control. Your inner life, there's more kind of continuity there. But ultimately, that too is uncertain. Ultimately, you get, you know, you lose your wisdom, you lose your meditation or whatever, and then you're back to kind of square one again. So the next step, and this is kind of where Buddhism gets really, really profound, is when you also go beyond the impermanence or the cessation of the internal phenomena and let go of that as well. And that is kind of the very deep aspects of the Buddhist path. The first step, letting go of the external world, takes you all the way to samadhi, takes you to the jhanas. If you want to go beyond the jhanas, all the way to nibbana, that's where you have to let go also of the inner world and also discard that. And then that is where nibbana happens. So very profound. So, you know, here, obviously, yeah, this is something we should focus on, Buddha's last teaching. And of course, the consequences of that, as I have just been pointed out, is that you start to take the spiritual life far more seriously. And that's why the advice, once you have the right view, all conditioned things are of a nature to cease. Once you have that right view, then what happens? Well, that happens then is strive on untiringly. Appamadena sampadeta. Sampadeta means like to succeed, yeah? Succeed through appamada, through heedfulness or through diligence or something like that. Be heedful, be diligent, but in the right way, and then you will succeed accordingly. So right view comes first. From right view comes the path, the striving or the work that we have to do. The whole Noble Eightfold Path is encompassed in that. Starting with right view, all the other seven factors come out of, is a way of looking at that striving, if you like, or that practice of those eight factors. So there you are. So this is what the Buddha said. So sometimes you need this kind of short teachings just to remind us. Yeah. So remind yourself of that. And in practice, what is that striving on untiringly that we should be doing? And in kind of ordinary life, one of the most simple ways of thinking about that, that I always like to mention because it's so easy to remember, is just the idea of kindness. If you can kind of imbue your entire life, everything you do, your thoughts, your actions, your speech, your perceptions, your intentions, everything with kindness, the more you can do that, you're going to be on this path in a very powerful way. So start with right view, reflect on impermanence, on cessation of things, and then kind of allow that to drive the kindness in your life. And then your meditation, everything else will follow along from that. Okay, so that is the Buddha's last words, the Tathagata's last words. So it's particularly interesting here. So what happens then here? Then the Lord entered the first jhana, and leaving that, he entered the second. Leaving that, he entered the third. Coming out of the third, he entered the fourth. Coming out of the fourth jhana, he entered the sphere of unbounded space. Coming out of that, he entered the sphere of unbounded consciousness. Coming out of that, he entered the sphere or the plane of nothingness. Coming out of that, he entered the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception. And coming out of that, he attained the cessation of feeling and perception. So here the Buddha is taking the idea of a calm meditation, of peaceful meditation, of samadhi, if you like, to its pinnacle. A cessation of feeling and perception is the very highest point. You can take any kind of samadhi. There's nothing beyond that. And the reason why there's nothing beyond that is because everything has ceased. You can't go beyond everything has ceased. That's the end of everything. There's nothing more to be done after that, obviously. So this is how this happens. And these states are extraordinarily profound. Yeah, even getting into a jhana state once, and some people do that on retreat occasionally, even getting that once has a kind of revolutionary effect on your life. But obviously, you go beyond that, and these are things where you go into these really exceptional states. And I think the only way to really understand any of this is actually to experience it. But the names give you some idea of what is going on. When you come to something like the second jhana, the world is already completely still, absolutely still. No movement is possible for hours at a time. And from then on, what you're doing is not becoming more still, because you can't become more still than absolutely still. Absolutely still is already kind of the limit. So from then on, what you're doing is that you are reducing the content of the mind instead. Your content is disappearing here. And so this is why every step here is more and more simple. The perception you have is more and more simple. There's less and less things, unless you get to the perception of nothingness. What is the perception of nothingness? This sounds pretty strange, yeah? You perceive nothingness. There's no perception of you, yeah? That's already gone a long time ago. It's a completely unified perception. All there is nothingness. That's all there is. Then you go to neither perception or non-perception. You don't even know whether you're perceiving anymore. It's kind of so subtle, you don't know what's going on. This is one of those states you cannot use for insight, because it's too subtle to be used for insight. And then finally, everything ceases. How do you know that everything has ceased? You're not there, right? So how can you possibly know? If everything has ceased, you're gone as well. So how can you possibly know that this has happened? It's one of those conundrums in Buddhism that you kind of think, especially when you're a young monk, you kind of reflect on these things. What is this all about? And you kind of try to figure out and go to Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn, how can this possibly be? And the way that you know these things is that because you can see the mind heading in that direction. And remember, when you come out of these states, you have an incredible clarity because your mind is supremely powerful. The most powerful mind you can have is the mind you have after one of these experiences. So you can see the whole process in retrospect and see what you went through with, you know, very, very clearly. And you can see the mind is heading towards cessation. Everything becoming simpler and simpler and simpler and simpler until suddenly everything stops. And then suddenly you re-emerge, and you have the first thing that re-emerges is a very simple mental state, which then gradually emerges into an ordinary consciousness again. So you can the way you know this is that, you know, 7 days disappeared in the middle there. So there must have happened, something must have happened. What happened to those 7 days? Okay, I went through this period, everything stopped. I came out again afterwards. And that's how you infer that things must have stopped for a period in between. So these are these states, but it's kind of amazing. Did anyone here like to stop? That sound good? It's hard to imagine, isn't it? Stopping completely. I mean, really being gone. It's not that you are feeling the stopping; you're actually gone completely. So again, to be able to get what this is about, you're going to have to experience it and see what it means. So this is, for example, one of the kind of strange things about the Buddhist path is that the fourth jhana, you have left behind all suffering and happiness. The fourth jhana is a state of neutral feeling or equanimity. The fourth jhana is better than happiness. Equanimity is better than happiness. It's one of those weird things on the Buddhist path. And again, of course, the only way you can get that is actually by experiencing it. So this is what the Buddha goes through. So let's, before I summarize or talk about why he's doing this, let's just go a little bit further, first of all. Then the Venerable Ananda said to Venerable Anuruddha, "Venerable Anuruddha, the Lord has passed away." "No, friend Ananda, the Lord has not passed away. He has attained the cessation of feeling and perception." Yeah, when someone is in that state, it looks like they passed away. There's no kind of sense of them being alive anymore. So it's kind of natural to think that, unless you have some kind of probably direct insight into reality and you can see what is going on. And Anuruddha was famous for his psychic powers, so he was probably reading the Buddha's mind. Kind of scary idea to read the Buddha's mind, isn't it? Anyway, I don't know what you think about that, but it sounds kind of slightly scary to me. Maybe I'm a scaredy cat. So he thinks that, but Anuruddha says he doesn't. There's a small little thing there that you might notice, which is slightly interesting in this context. I just want to point it out. You noted that Venerable Ananda says Venerable Anuruddha. He calls him Bhante. And whereas Anuruddha says friend to Ananda. Now, until this point, they have all been friends, all been on friendly terms. But you may remember from the last time that the Buddha says, "After my passing away, a more junior monk should call a more senior monk Bhante, whereas a more senior monk should call a more junior monk Avuso." Avuso is like the more friendly term to use. So now they've already started on that. Yeah, they kind of follow the Buddha's instructions to the letter here. This is what you're seeing here. So I thought I might just point that out. I'm not sure if yeah, please, go for it. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And yes, of course, the standards of praise can be the best in this Dhamma.
Yeah.
So, what's the length scale, the time scale involved in this process?
It's a good question. Yes, that's a good question, isn't it? Because usually these attainments, they are very long, yeah? And usually it is said that if you go into a third or fourth jhana, 10 hours is quite not uncommon for these attainments to last. Ending of the cessation of perception of feeling, sanya, vidayata, nirodha, can last up to 7 days, apparently. So you sit there like a rock for 7 days, nothing is happening, people think you're dead, they put you on a big funeral pyre, they try to burn you up, but the next day you come into the village again, and you brush... So this is the point. But remember, the point here is that is the maximum length. Yeah. So I think the point here is that someone like the Buddha, remember, one of the ideas of of being a master of samadhi is that you can determine the length of these states. You are able to go in and out as you please. So obviously the Buddha would have mastered these states to the maximum. So he would have gone into these things at fairly short time. It wouldn't have been long times. So this is what is going on here. So that is the only way this makes any sense, because otherwise they would have taken weeks to go through this sequence, yeah, which would kind of make the whole thing sound a bit silly here. So yeah. Is it a demonstration to his disciples? Maybe. Yeah, maybe that's part of it. Yeah, I mean, he obviously has taught these things before, so they are part of the suttas as well. But maybe this is a practical demonstration. Yeah, maybe. So, yeah. But I think there's something else going on. I'll come back to that in a second. Yeah. So then, going on to the next paragraph here, then the Lord, leaving the attainment of cessation of feeling and perception, entered the sphere of neither perception nor perception. Emerging from that, he entered the sphere of nothingness. Emerging from that, he entered the sphere of boundless consciousness. Leaving that, he entered the sphere of boundless space. Leaving that, he entered the fourth jhana. Leaving that, he entered the third jhana. Leaving that, the second jhana. Leaving that, the first jhana. Leaving the first jhana, he entered the second jhana. Leaving the second jhana, he entered the third jhana. Leaving that, he entered the fourth jhana. And leaving the fourth jhana, the Lord finally passed away. It sounds like a very elaborate thing to go through, to pass away. And we are bound to ask the question, why is this happening? If you didn't ask this question, it would be very strange, because it is so elaborate and so kind of, you know, perhaps unexpected. How come we just didn't just die and kind of got it all over with? What is the purpose of all this? So, and I don't really know. I think the purpose of all this, this is just a guess. The purpose of all of this, you will notice that the Buddha passed away after the fourth jhana. And of course, one of the things about the fourth jhana is that it is the state where, according to the suttas, your breathing stops. And then you can be in that state without breathing for 10 hours. So how is that possible? If you don't breathe for 10 hours, most people, you'd normally die. If you don't breathe for 10 minutes, people die. I think there are some records, apparently, people not breathing, being underwater for up to 40 minutes is kind of the absolute maximum. But here we're talking about long, long periods of time. How is that possible? And the reason why it is possible is that as you calm down, you're not just calming down your mind, you're calming down your entire metabolism to the point where the metabolism comes to a temporary halt. Yeah, it's a bit like hibernating. Animals in hibernation are a little bit like that. The metabolism goes way, way down. But here, you bring it to a complete halt. And of course, when the metabolism has come to a halt, no need for any oxygen anymore. If there's no need for any oxygen, you don't have to breathe. And this is why this is possible. Yeah. And I was reading about some experiments that have been done recently where they induce the state of non-metabolism in people. Yeah, they've done it on animals and dogs and things before. And what they do is that they tap out all the blood. All the blood is tapped out of the taken out of the body, and it's replaced by some kind of saline solution. And then when the saline solution goes into the body, yeah, they've already started to cool it down. That saline solution is at a lower temperature, so they cool the body down very rapidly. And when that body gets cooled down, apparently it has a similar effect to what you are probably seeing here. You get put into suspended animation, is what they call it. And then they can have the body like that for hours, come out afterwards, and the body is perfectly fine. So my guess is that what the Buddha is doing here is that he knows that his body is going to have to be on display for many days afterwards. One of the most famous spiritual master in human history is going to be take a long time to do all the funeral, the rites and rituals and people saying goodbye and all of these kind of things. And because he knows that, I suspect he leaves his body in a state whereby it can last for 7 days without really rotting or without anything happening to it. It's a way of putting the body into a kind of suspended animation, if you like. Yeah. And this is what I suspect is going on here. Because it would have been probably quite devastating for people to see people, the Buddha's body starting to rot. You can imagine what that would feel like, maybe smell and all these kind of things. So he uses his power of meditation to avoid that. This is what I think is happening here. And this is why he first of all takes it down all the way down to, this is just speculation by the way, I don't really know, because it doesn't say in a way why he's doing this, but it seems like a possible solution anyway to this strange conundrum. That's why he takes it all the way down to complete cessation of perception and feeling, because that is the deepest kind of peace. And then from that he goes back to the fourth jhana, via the first jhana, back to the fourth jhana, so to achieve a maximum kind of calming down of the body here. Just a guess. I don't know. That's kind of what I think might be happening here. It could maybe be as Huitong is suggesting as well, that maybe there's some kind of demonstration of the samadhi here. I don't know, but what do people think? Is that a sensible solution to this rather strange sequence of events? Supernatural. All this relic stuff, I'm very skeptical. I'm very, and there's many reasons for that. One of the interesting things about the, people see what they want to see so much of the time, and they see multiplication, they see all kind of stuff, and I'm not impressed by a lot of the evidence that I hear here. And who knows? I mean, there's weird things happening in this world. So I'm not going to kind of say categorically it's impossible. That would be very arrogant if I did that. But it seems to me that there's lots of reasons for being skeptical about these things. One of the interesting things was when they burn relics in certain places. If you burn them above a certain temperature, they actually do crystallize automatically. Yeah, so this is one of the reasons why I think you get crystals, because they get burnt at very high temperatures, then they crystallize, you get crystallized bones. And then they say, oh, there must be an arahant because they crystallized. No, it's the temperature, not the arahantship, that makes the difference. The bones of the Buddha that were one of the best examples, the most likely, with the bones with the best pedigree, to put it that way, are the bones that are found in the museum in New Delhi, because these were found in this ancient place that hadn't been disturbed for a couple of thousand years. And then it was dug out towards the end of the 19th century by a British landowner called Pepe, who happened to own that estate, and he saw this mound, okay, let's dig it out, and they found these relics. And this is very likely to have been Kapilavastu, ancient Kapilavastu, and the relics coming from that area. So they have a very, very good chance of being real relics. No other relics anywhere come even close to having such a good chance of being relics. Maybe with the exception of relics that were found in Benares, in Saranat, because they were mostly thrown into the river Ganges at some point. So they were ordinary bones. They were not crystallized, and presumably because the heat wasn't enough to crystallize them. And those were the bones of the Buddha. If there is one arahant in the world, surely that arahant must be the Buddha. So, all of this, I take, sometimes faith can make you blind, and this is kind of, I think, happens too often in Buddhism. We need to find this middle way somehow between not throwing out the baby with the bathwater, not throwing out those things that really matter, like rebirth or whatever, but also have a healthy skepticism to some of these things. Maybe I'm putting some people off by being so skeptical, but that's just me, You can just reject my words straight away if you think I'm being kind of overly skeptical, but that's how I see these things. Anyway, do you want to say anything about that? No, you don't want to say anything? Okay, good. Yeah. I'm very glad. Yes, who are you talking?
It seems in my mind, I may be sure, probably not me, but I don't
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's so the fact that it's unremarkable, that's remarkable. Yeah. Remarkably unremarkable. Yeah. So has it been carbon dated? I don't think so, because I don't think anyone would be allowed to get their hands on it to carbon date it. I think that's the problem. Yeah. I know that Adan Sujato, he was recently trying to carbon date a manuscript from Sri Lanka, because they had some ancient manuscript there. It goes back to the 13th century. It's one of the oldest manuscripts in existence of Pali manuscript. That's how far back they go, to the 13th century. And he was trying to get a small corner of this manuscript so he could carbon date it. Yeah, you can guess the age from all kind of other things. The way it is written, the language that is used, the kind of type of handwriting. There's lots of ways, the material that is used. So the dating is pretty sure anyway, but carbon dating is probably one of the most secure ways. But that was impossible. Nobody would allow him to do that. And he had connections with some people in Sydney. Apparently they have some kind of reactor in Sydney where they do carbon dating. And he had connection with some scholars, kind of all this stuff, and he was ready to do the carbon dating, but they weren't willing to lend him a small corner. So you can imagine that was just a manuscript. Imagine the bones of the Buddha. Yeah, there's no way you get those carbon dated, I think. So politics or whatever. It would be nice to have it, but the problem is that sometimes even if you get it carbon dated, I don't know what people. Yeah, I guess that would. I guess that would probably settle the issue actually. Yeah. It would increase faith that those particular bones might have been from the Buddha. Yeah, they would. Yeah. It would have been nice. I agree with you. For me, it would have been nice. Some people probably wouldn't make any difference, but yeah, yeah. Eddie. Yeah. You share these things in a general way. Yeah, you talk about these things, and sometimes you get the feeling whether someone knows it just by the way they talk about it. You get a feeling, but you can't claim, you can't say, I attain these things.
Yes.
Because these are called the Uttari Manusadhamma, superhuman states. Yeah, yeah. So just listen to how people talk about it. And I don't know about you, but when I listen to Ajahn Ram, I sort of get the feeling, well, he knows quite a bit about this, a lot. I've been around him for 25 years. But and there are, of course, a few monks like that around the world. Some nuns perhaps as well, some lay people even perhaps, but not many. They are, not in large numbers, that's for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, yeah. Well, I mean, the Buddha wouldn't have had an attachment anyway, yeah. But I think it's some part of that is true. It would have been very easy in part. But I think the main reason why it is easy is because the body is so incredibly tranquil. Most people, when they die, the body becomes stiff soon afterwards. Yeah, rigor mortis, whatever they call it, and it becomes very difficult to handle and all these kind of negative things straight away. But if you pass away in this way, I suspect it would be very different. Maybe we should have some people to volunteer in the Buddhist society, yeah? Okay, when I pass away, I will pass away in the fourth jhana. Any volunteers? Then we'll test the body afterwards. It'll be interesting, yeah? A real-life experiment and see what happens. Yeah. Yeah. Why not, yeah? Yeah, why not exactly? Yeah? 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 Why not, yeah? 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 Yeah. 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 If you notice, though, he doesn't actually die in the fourth jhana, he dies just after. He comes out, yeah? Immediately afterwards. So the body would be very peaceful, no pain, nothing, just kind of ending of everything, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah. Do you want to volunteer for the experiment? We have to certify you first of all as a four-star practitioner. You have to get the stamp certificate. Bang, Ananda. Go to Ashram Ram and get it certified. Okay. Yeah. 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 Yeah, these things are just so inscrutable. You know, even if you hear stories, I wouldn't, you know, hold much store by those stories. It's just so unreliable and uncertain. So. Oh, really? Okay, yeah. I've never heard that, so I don't know. That's true. There were some stories about, I think that was why he was still alive. They did blood tests, and he was kind of apparently completely, so there was something there that was interesting, that was fully oxygenated while he seemed to be completely unconscious or out of it or something. Something like that happened, yeah. So, yeah. 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 But you know, generally speaking, I don't think we should expect and wait for kind of scientific proof of these things, because that is endless. You keep on doing one proof, and then there's more tests to be done, and you keep on endless. In the meantime, Buddhism dies out in the meantime. So, you know, this is usually how things go. I know Ajahn Brahm was once invited to do some meditation experiments, I think in the United States, and he refused flat out, because it is endless. You get into those things, there's no, you know, no end to it. Okay, so this is the Buddha's passing away. How do you feel? Okay, yeah, not too sad. Imagine if you had, now it's kind of a nice story, it doesn't make you very sad, yeah, but imagine being there when this happens, yeah, would have been incredibly, extraordinarily powerful. Okay, let's go on a little bit longer, if you are okay. As always, if you need to leave, please feel free to leave at any time, but I'd like to go a little bit over the hour, if that's okay. Yeah. And at the Blessed Lord's final passing away, there was a great earthquake, terrible and hair-raising, accompanied by thunder. And Brahma Sahampati uttered this verse. All beings in the world, all bodies must break up. Even the teacher, peerless in the human world, the mighty Lord and perfect Buddha has passed away. So Brahma Sahampati was famous. He was the one who also asked the Buddha to start his teaching. Yeah, so he would be the one who really understood what the Buddha was about. And for that reason, he then utters this verse. All beings in the world, everything is impermanent. This also underlines the idea of, of vaya dhamma sankhara, all conditioned phenomena, including the Buddha himself. The Buddha is also a conditioned phenomena, and we all are conditioned phenomena. So that too must pass away and break up and cease eventually. Here, that's really all it is saying here. And Sakka, the ruler of the devas, Tavatingsa heaven, uttered this verse. Impermanent are compounded things, prone to rise and fall. Having risen, they are destroyed. The passing is the truest bliss. This is Sakka's verse, and I don't know if you recognize that verse. Anicca Sankhara, exactly, this is the Anicca Sankhara verse. It's not the translation, I'm not very impressed by the translation, to be honest, but this is the Anicca Vata Sankara Upadavaya Dhammino Upajitava Nirujanti Tesang Vupassamo Sukho. And a very famous one is if you go to a Buddhist funeral, this is usually chanted at the Buddhist funeral, just as it was at the time of the Buddha, so we kind of keep on doing it, and nobody understands a word of what is going on, but nevertheless, we keep on chanting it in a Pali language. So here, Anicca Vata Sankara means, impermanent, or unreliable are all compounded things or all conditioned phenomena or something like that. Upada vaya dhammeno, upada and vaya again are these ideas of not rise and fall so much. Rise and fall is a dangerous translation, because rise and fall can give the idea that there is something there which rises and falls. But the point is not that there's something there which rises and falls. The word vaya means come to an end, as I just mentioned before. It means cessation. So it means compounded things come into existence and they cease. That is what it means. They arise and they disappear, would have been a much better translation. They have the nature, the Dhamma. Dhammata means nature, to arise and then pass away afterwards. This is what this really means. And it makes it simple little things like that can make a big difference in how we understand the Dhamma. Because that rise and fall, straight away, it opens up the possibility of different interpretations, which actually can be very dangerous and give rise to the idea of some kind of substrate or something like that, which is always there, yeah? Whereas at surface level, things just rise and fall, so to speak, yeah? And then having arisen, they are destroyed. Well, in this case, it is better, yeah? They end or they cease, and they're passing, vupassamo, they're calming, quite literally, they're calming down, the calming down of them. In other words, they're ending, and no more sankharas. This is happiness, sukha. This is the real happiness in the world. This is what Sakka, the Lord of the Gods, say, and this is what we all say these days. So whenever you hear these words being said by the monks, now you know what is going on. Anicca vata sankhara, upada vaya dhammeno, upa jitva nirujanti, te sang vupassamo sukho. Then we have the Venerable Anuruddha, and the Venerable Anuruddha uttered this verse, no breathing in and out, just with a steadfast heart. The sage who is free from desire has passed away to peace. With mind unshaken, he endures all pains. By extinguishment, the illumined's mind is freed. Let me just read this in another translation, just to give you an idea of how these things can be translated differently. This is Bhantasujato's translation. There was no more breathing for the poised one of steady heart, imperturbable, committed to peace. The sage has done his time. This means died, basically. He put up with painful feelings without flinching. The liberation of his heart was like the extinguishing of a lamp. Pajota, the lamp. This is actually missed by Maurice Walsh in his translation. So this is quite different. Yeah, you can see here how the same thing can be translated in different ways, and some of these ways are more reliable than others. And then the Venerable Ananda uttered this verse. Terrible was the quaking. Men's hair stood on end when the all-accomplished Buddha passed away. Adansujato again. Then there was terror. Then they had goosebumps when the Buddha, endowed with all fine qualities, became fully extinguished. Goosebumps. Loma hangsana, literally hair standing on end. That's what it means. So goosebumps actually probably quite a good translation. And those monks who had not yet overcome their passions or their desires, they wept and tore their hair, raising their arms, throwing themselves down, and twisting and turning, crying, all too soon the Blessed One has passed away, all too soon the welfare has passed away, all too soon the eye of the world has disappeared. But those monks who were free from craving endured mindfully and clearly aware, saying, all compounded things are impermanent. What is the use of this? So that is it. What is the use of this? Has been translating by Adasudato as, how could it possibly be otherwise? That is what it is. What he says there. So I'll just carry on just a little bit more, and then we'll make a stop very soon. Then the Venerable Anuruddha said, friends, enough with your weeping and wailing. Has not the Lord already told you that all things that are pleasant and delightful are changeable, subject to separation and to becoming otherwise? So why all this, friends? Whatever is born, become, compounded, is subject to decay. It cannot be that it does not decay. So again, the idea of impermanence coming kind of all the way through here. And now, of course, the idea of the Buddha passing away is one of the most powerful indications of impermanence that you can possibly have. Everything really is impermanent. The most dear thing in the universe, if you are a Buddhist, nothing can be more dear than the Buddha, who opens up the path to happiness, who gives you access to meaning, to happiness, to all good things in the world. That too must pass away. And of course, eventually, the scary thing about this, that we should always remember that the Buddha still, in a sense, remains in the world. He remains in the world through his Dhamma. He remains in the world through his enlightened disciples that are still around. But that too will disappear one day. One day the Dhamma will be gone. One day all enlightened disciples will also have disappeared. Yeah, that's kind of scary, because this is kind of the eye. Yeah, it gives us the ability to see the world clearly. It is so hard. It may seem so obvious in some ways once you learn the Dhamma. But actually, it is so hard to get there without that support. So it reminds you of the impermanence of the Buddha. Also means the Dhamma and the Sangha and everything else, the path, also is impermanent. So keep that in mind. It kind of gives you a bit of impetus on doing what is right. Yes, Bill. Why is that an earthquake? Yeah. There is an interesting, I didn't mention this before actually earlier on, because we talked about earthquakes, because it happens earlier on in the sutta, and there is a passage there which says that there are 8 causes of earthquakes. And the 8 causes of the earthquake, one is natural cause, yeah, the kind of the earth shakes for natural reasons. The way it is explained is a bit different from what you would expect from a modern point of view, obviously, because I didn't really understand the mechanics of it. The second one is a supernormal power. You can make the earth shake to supernormal powers. And the third one is the Buddha's passing away here. Yeah, so these are 3 of the 8, and all the other ones are the other various stages of the Buddha's life. But what is interesting about that is that there is a sutta, another version of the same sutta, which first of all mentions 3 reasons for earthquakes. Then it gets expanded to 8. And this shows you a little bit how the suttas work. Sometimes suttas are expanded, new elements are added to what was earlier on, a simpler list. And the simpler list, obviously, the ordinary earthquakes make the earth shake by supernormal power, and the Buddha's passing away, that is obviously earlier. And then later on, they add all these other earthquakes to different stages of the Buddha's life. That already takes away some of that question. Yeah, so that leaves only 1 earthquake when the Buddha passed away. So did the earth actually quake when the Buddha passed away? And I don't know, maybe it did. The world has many strange things going on. Maybe they were, the devas were around, maybe some of them had these supernormal powers, maybe they were kind of so aggrieved that kind of everything just shook as a consequence. The world and the mind are much more intertwined than we normally think from a modern scientific point of view. Yeah, there's a very strong interconnection between the world and the mind. And for that reason, sometimes weird things that this may happen. So I don't know. I think very well it may have happened. You're right, nobody says much about it, which is kind of, you wonder. But then again, it may not have been recorded because it was irrelevant what people said about it. Yeah, it was the Buddha's passing away that was focused on. So you just don't know. Eddie?
I think the following brings a question of earthquake.
Yeah.
From what I read, it says there are 2 types of earthquake. One is horizontal, one is vertical.
Right, yeah.
And one is good earthquake, and the other one is bad earthquake. In the bad earthquake, people get killed.
Okay.
Good earthquake, people get enlightened or
thinking. Okay. What is your source for this particular theory?
I think it's the Master Swan
Wasp. Uh-huh. I would recommend you to always look at the sources. Where do things come from? Where do they originate from? Yeah. Sources is very important in Buddhism. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
There's power which we
Yeah, yeah. You mean power that makes earthquakes, you mean? Yeah. Earthquake power? Yeah. Yeah. You accumulate mental energy, yeah?
Yeah?
And mental energy is a kind of power, yeah? So you certainly, yeah? Yeah? Yeah. Metaphor, it feels like it's almost like it's so strong a powerful mode that it feels like the world is shaking in a sense. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting point. Yeah. So that's what kind of your perception the emotional power was so strong that it kind of was almost like an earthquake in a sense. Yeah, yeah. Mm. Okay. Okay, I'll finish off one more paragraph here, then we'll call it a day. So the Devas, friends, are grumbling here. Venerable Anuruddha, what kind of Devas are you aware of? Friend Ananda, they are sky Devas whose minds are earthbound, that are weeping and tearing the hair. And there are earth Devas whose minds are earthbound, they do likewise. But those Devas who are free from craving endure patiently, saying, all compounded things are impermanent. What is the use of this? And this is a very good reminder to just remember that Devas are in large part just like human beings. The difference is actually very small, especially when in terms of things like wisdom. There are some Devas who are ignorant. Yeah, they may be beautiful, they may be powerful in some ways, but from a Dhamma point of view, they may still be ignorant just like most human beings. And then there are some Devas who are more enlightened, yeah, and who have more insight into these teachings, just like some human beings are. So sometimes people want to get the answers from the Devas. Yeah, if a Deva comes to you and tells you, do this, then be skeptical. I don't know if you ever had that experience. Sometimes people may have some super normal experiences, but it doesn't mean just because something is amazing and marvelous and astonishing doesn't necessarily mean that there is any wisdom behind it. And that's one of those important things to remember from the Buddha's point of view. Okay, I'm going to stop there. And I think, and this is kind of it's very strange to say, but I think next time we might be able to finish this sutta. I feel almost sad already now. It's almost like the Buddha's life is coming to an end. You come to the end of the sutta after almost 3 years, but yeah, we can start again. We probably could actually, we just keep on doing the sutta round and round, because it is so full. Everything is really there, yeah. So you don't actually have to do anything else. So that's true. Any last comments or questions or is everyone? Yes, it's been there. On the internet. Yeah, go to suttacentral.net and just click on the appropriate links and you will find it all there. It's all available there. Yeah, yeah. Anyone else want to say anything? Yeah. And does anyone have any really stupid questions? We want to hear some stupid questions as well, because sometimes we get... please don't be afraid of asking, because there's always beginners coming to the sutta class. Yeah, and you're more than welcome to ask anything you like. Yes, yeah, Stephen, good. It is quite. I think it is quite possible that it was added, because we know already that the earthquakes were added, because we know that there's one list of three and one list of eight. One list is very likely to be earlier than the other one. It was expanded. So we know that there is a propensity to add already. So it is quite possible. And so, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Kanchana, you want to say something? Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. How they relate to the jhanas, that would mean, basically. Yeah, yeah. Well, the way these things are, you know, normally when you find these things in the suttas, they all come in hierarchies and in particular sequences. And the four Brahmaviharas always come after the four jhanas. And then after the Brahmaviharas, then you have the immaterial attainments. So there is always a clear kind of sequence there, and it shows you that the Brahmaviharas, when they're developed fully, they're actually considered higher than the four jhanas. So for example, you might come out of a jhana, and then you might develop the Brahmavihara based on that, and that becomes, then you can imagine how powerful that would become. Yeah, really, really powerful. I don't think there is necessarily any absolute connection between them. But there is one sutta in the, I think, Bhojanga Sanghita, in the connected discourses on the awakening factor, that says that the highest expression of the Brahmaviharas are found in the, I think, in the immaterial realm. So the Karuna, for example, is actually found in infinite consciousness or something like that. And I can't remember now the exact correlation between them. And Mudita is found, I think, in the sphere of nothingness. And Upeka, yeah. So they are actually somehow related to the immaterial realms, according to this one particular sutta in the Bhojangas, the highest expression of these things. But I think you're right. I think the fourth Brahmavihara is very closely related to the fourth jhana, obviously, because of the upeka factor there. Yeah. So if you go searching in the Bhojanga Sanghita, you should be able to find something there. Yeah. Yes? Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It's possible, but your meditation has to be deep. Yeah, you have to go to a state of samadhi, and sometimes devas can apparently almost look like nimittas. You have a nimitta in your meditation. It can be very similar, but not exactly the same. There will be differences because it will be more moving, perhaps, or more. So yeah. I think. According to the suttas, both are possible. It's possible to have conversation with the devas. The Buddha, before his awakening, he said that I didn't consider myself fully awakened until I had conversed with the devas and understood them fully, what karma got them there and how long their lifespan is, and having conversed with them and talked to them and all of these kind of things. So it's possible, but I suppose it depends on how you kind of develop your mind, what you will experience. So is that where you want to head in that direction? Huh? Is that?
Yeah.
Oh, just yeah. 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 So I've heard of people who actually have experienced these things, and I have no doubt. I don't doubt that really. So, Eddie. I think in theory it might be right. In theory, devas might be able to somehow, sometimes interfere in human things. It might be possible. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about, for example, we talk about UFO sightings. Yeah, we're talking about people claiming to be abducted. And apparently some of this evidence from people being abducted and seeing UFOs, apparently some of it is very credible, apparently. This is the weird thing. We tend to kind of dismiss those things as if they are kind of, you know, people who are gone nuts and kind of have these ideas. But apparently some of them are very credible. And that is what is so interesting about it. So you wonder whether that might be cases of the devas or some interaction between the human realm and the deva realm from a Buddhist point of view, perhaps. I don't believe in flying saucers from other planets, but who knows, but I don't really believe in that. But I might believe in devas, yeah, interfering in our realm. But to me, the point is that, yes, they are there, but usually they are occupied with their own affairs. They are playing around in the famous Nandana Grove, you know, amusing themselves in heaven, and they look at human beings as some kind of dirty species, yeah, because they are very pure and all of these things. So I don't think they're all that interested unless there is something special to be done in interfering. So one of the problems in a large part of the Buddhist world is that we, instead of practicing the Buddhist path, there's a very common in the Buddhist world to pray to spirits and to leave food for spirits and to ask the spirits for help. And that is where I think we go dramatically wrong. This is not really what the Buddhist path is about. The Buddha doesn't say we should be praying to spirits and asking for spirits. There's nothing about that in the suttas. So even though they may theoretically be able to help us, we need to get back to reality. Buddhism shouldn't be about, you know, spirit worship. It should be about practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. If you go to most Buddhist households around the world, there's a lot of the kind of little chaityas in the back garden, spirit house or whatever, for, you know, for looking after the spirits. And that is where we have gone down the wrong track. And we are kind of putting too much emphasis on that side of things. So that's why I don't really encourage people to think like that, because it is already going the wrong direction. And sometimes, maybe occasionally it might help, but a lot of time they're not going to bother about us anyway. And then you're just kind of praying for asking for help for absolutely no reason. Yeah. So that's why I look at it. Yes, we talk. Yes. Yeah.
Now, is the earth here refers to the planet Earth?
Yeah.
Is the earth here refers to the earth of Mount Meru and the sky of the beyond Mount Meru?
Yeah. I'm just looking up now the Pali words. We don't have a microphone today, so maybe the questions are not being heard well. Yeah. 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 Deva Pattavi Sanya. Pattavi is earth. So they are mentioned there. Yes. Okay. I just want to read the Pali because I want to know what I'm talking about before, what actually is meant here by sky and earth in the Pali. There is nothing here. It doesn't say a sky here anywhere. This is the weird thing. Oh, wait a minute. Sandadeva akasa. Okay, part of his sun, you know. Okay, yeah. Okay, so akasa means literally the air. And Pattavi means the earth. Yeah, Pattavi actually means the earth. So this is obviously about the earth and the air, yeah, the atmosphere here. So I think the idea is that, you know, the physical world can be seen from different perspectives. And the human perspective is only one way of understanding the physical world. So we look at it, so we see the physical world in one way. If you get reborn as a ghost or the deva, you can still relate to the same physical world, but from a different perspective. Yeah, it's just, in other words, the world around us can be seen from different angles depending on which realm you're in, but there will be an imprint of that world in that different realm. So that is why a ghost, for example, you get reborn in the ghost realm, you can't see them because they're actually in a different realm, but that realm too will have a certain imprint of this world. So a ghost will then be, for example, you die in a certain house and you will still be attached to that house because you were able to see it from that realm in a different way. So this is what I think this means. You're still kind of somehow involved with this world, but there is a kind of different perception of this world from a different angle, a higher angle, if you like. And that is why they can talk about this in this particular way.
So we are talking about this world that we are familiar with.
Yeah, but from a... But, yeah. Yeah, so it is in a sense this world, but it's, in a sense it's not this world, yeah? It's kind of both at the same time, yeah.
It's not talking about the mythology,
how things are, and cosmology, which sometimes, claim that. Yeah, probably not, but maybe it is. Maybe that Mount Meru is kind of added on top of the earth in that alternative. I don't know. It does look like it. There's nothing really much about Mount Meru in the suttas. Yeah, it is mentioned. Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. Yeah, basically. That's my understanding. Yeah. Ainsley, do you want to say anything? Yeah. Well, actually, thank you very much. I was actually going to talk about that, but it had slipped my mind because this is such an important point, and I think at this particular thing here. And one of the, I think, very powerful messages in this particular sutta is that you see here, even the monks who were almost enlightened, like Venerable Ananda, yeah, he was obviously very distressed before the Buddha passes away, and he's crying, and the Buddha has to kind of support him and tell, you know, what you expect, everything is impermanent, all these kind of things. Many of the monks and the lay people and the devas who you see here, quite likely they were on the path already to awakening. They are crying. Those who are arahants, like Venerable Anuruddha, they say, what's the point of crying? Hasn't the Buddha told you everything is impermanent? He doesn't say the Buddha will be around afterwards. He says, everything is impermanent. What do you expect? And it's a very powerful point that shows you that when an arahant dies or the Buddha dies, they are gone. Yeah, this is kind of, I think, one of the very core messages that actually comes out of this. They are gone. And a lot of Buddhism in the present day are claims about arahants and the Buddha that are very, very hard to reconcile with this particular outlook here. So sometimes you will hear that Buddhas come to you in your meditation practice or arahants come, and if you ask them what they mean, well, they actually literally mean that these Buddhas come from the past. And when you hear that, I would say that you have the very, you know, we have to be very careful how to interpret that. There's many different ways of interpreting. One way of interpreting it is simply as some mental image that you have in deep meditation, because you can have all kinds of mental images, and people may have images of people helping them or whatever. That's one way of interpreting it. But one way we should not interpret it, and if that is what is meant, then it is basically wrong view. The idea that something is there, that is still a reflection of the Buddha coming back to us, because the Buddha is gone. He's not there anymore. If you say the Buddha comes back to you and you mean that literally, well, basically you haven't understood what is going on. You haven't understood impermanence. You haven't understood non-self, and it's a very big problem. And that is, in large part, one of those things which you see around the Buddhist world is this tendency to see eternalism in the Buddha's teachings. It's a very powerful drive in human beings. We want to exist, we want something to be there. It tends to take over Buddhism, unfortunately, sometimes. So thank you very much, Ainsley, for pointing that out, because that's actually a very important point that I wanted to talk about anyway, but I completely skipped my mind. Anyone else want to say anything here? No? Okay. Okay, great. Yeah. So we have some questions from outside the Buddha Center. Yeah. Thank you, Chris. So a few questions, all of them from overseas. And the first one is from India. Do you know this person, Venerable? You might know him. Might be one of your mates in India. It's really nice. We have Venerable Nibbato is originally from India. You're Aussie now, right? But you're born in India and everything. It's kind of cool. Buddhism is kind of going back to the homeland with a powerful way. That's really great. Anyway, question from India. What do we know about the historical Channa's role in Siddhartha Gautama's life from the suttas versus the mythological figure? And the answer is we know zip, zilch, and nothing. Because the only thing we know about Venerable Channa is that he was a monk who had lots of problems with fitting into the monastic life, and there's at least three or four or five, at least three that I can think of straight off the top of my head, of rules, some of them very important rules, Sangha Disesa number 12, one of the very heavy rules of the monks, Pachitya number 12, one of the less heavy rules, and Pachitya number 53, 54, Anadarya Pachityang, all of these rules, and I think there are a couple more which I can't remember, all based on him being difficult, being obstinate, being disrespectful to the Sangha, etc., etc., etc. That is what we know. As far as him being the charioteer, it is all part of the mythology, and we don't really, it's very hard to know for any degree of certainty whether there is any connection there or not. Maybe there is. You never know. Maybe something has passed down, outside of the suttas. Sometimes that does happen. But a lot of that is, at the very least, it's very unreliable. Okay, from Lithuania. In the Velama Sutta, the Buddha mentioned that above all the merits, the highest one is to develop, even for just a fingersnap, the perception of inconsistency, in other words, impermanence. Why is that? And the Velama Sutta, in case you don't know, is a sutta found in the Anguttara Nikaya, the nines, I think it's number 20. Number 20. And this is a sutta of a hierarchy of good karma, or merit that you make. And it starts off with like giving to, giving to an ordinary person or something like that, or giving to an immoral person, and then going up and up and up. And then it kind of giving a dwelling to the Sangha is one of the highest acts of generosity. And beyond generosity comes taking the triple refuge, then taking the five precepts, then developing the mind of metta, and then developing the idea of impermanence being the highest one. Why is that the highest? And the reason is because when it talks about impermanence here, anicca sanya, and developing that, it doesn't just mean that in the ordinary sense. It means taking it to the highest sense. Yeah? So when you develop anicca sanya in this way, it means having the full insight into impermanence. That is what is really meant by this. So you actually become a stream enter, basically. And that is why the merit is so high. Because once you are a stream enter, you have given up all lower realms, yeah, that is obviously a sign of very high merit, and you can expect a lot of happiness in the future as a consequence, and you have really, this is, for that reason, is the highest merit. All of these other ones are much more uncertain. At that point, you're bound for Nibbana, and that is why the merit, you know, it's called the highest merit, because you can expect the highest happiness as a consequence of that. So I hope that makes sense. It does say for just a finger snap, you're right, but remember here, it really means profound insight into the nature of reality. Otherwise, this passage doesn't make any sense. So Okay, last one from the USA. How did they know the Buddha passed away after the fourth jhana, if he did pass away? You mean he didn't tell them? Is that what you mean? Remember that the point here is that they had monks around that that could read the minds of the Buddha in the middle there. And maybe that's the point, actually. Maybe that's the point of that passage. Now that you mentioned, that's interesting. Because the Buddha goes down to cessation. His mind stops completely. And Ananda, Venerable Ananda, says, oh, the Buddha has passed away. And Anuruddha says, no, he has not. He is in Nirodha. Maybe the point of that is to show that Venerable Anuruddha is there to read his mind. Maybe that's the whole point of that passage. Because that then shows you how this was known. Yeah? So that could be the reason. Actually, that's an interesting point. That hasn't occurred to me before. Yes? Yeah. Yeah, but it still requires someone around to read the mind to know what's going on here. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure, but it requires someone to read the Buddha's mind to know what's going on. Otherwise, they wouldn't have known what's happening. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that is how they knew it. Yeah, they knew it by the Buddhist idea of mind reading. He would be able to read the Buddha's state of mind. He would have known he was in the fourth jhana and then passed away. That is how that would have been known. This is kind of the Buddhist, supposed to be the Buddhist higher power, is able to read somebody else's mind. Okay. Okay, that's it for today. Everyone happy? Yeah? Yeah, very good. Okay. Great. Okay, let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.